Hello, welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo. Today's guest is author Jamie Harrison. Jamie is a writer and editor. She has written 4 novels previously, all set in Montana, where she's lived for the past 30 years. Jamie Harrison, welcome to Between the Covers.
Thanks for having me.
Today we're talking about your newest book, The Widow Nash, released in June 2017, that has been called an adventurous story of escape, identity, and rebirth with dynamic and fascinating characters. It's an old Western mixed with a Victorian classic, all with a fierce feminist twist. Could you give us a summary of the book?
It's about a woman named Dulcie Renfrey, whose father is a mining engineer. It's set in 1904, begins then. And her father's ill. Her father's lost a huge sum of money. And Dulcie finds herself in a place where she has to reinvent herself. She has to run for a new life.
And that is what is so intriguing about it. So as you mentioned, the main character is Dulcie Renfrey, and she's a strong female, well-traveled, she has a head for business. Given that the story takes place in the early 1900s, one thing that really stuck out to me was just how independent Dulcie was. So she was traveling the world, she broke off an engagement, she stood up for herself numerous times in the face of pretty powerful men. Can you tell us about why you went this route with her?
I went this route because I'd done a bunch of research about the turn of the century. A lot of it had centered around the town of Butte, Montana, and I was struck by reading newspaper articles and letters and things like that, how many people really were fairly independent, how many people didn't really do exactly what they were supposed to do according to the society's say-so, and in fact, how much more open-minded, at least in the West and in parts of the U.S., society was at that time. It wasn't quite the Victorian, Edwardian thing that we think of, and I really wanted to write something that addressed that. And in fact, you know, if you read literature, you read diaries of the time, English, American, any country, you find that people truly didn't always behave.
Well, that's really interesting that, you know, you found that in your research, because I feel like most of the historical fiction I've read is, as a woman, you don't have a say in your life, and you have to do whatever the men in your life tell you to do. So it was really refreshing, too.
That actually drives me nuts. Yeah, and I think it was largely in reaction to that. We all like to think that our grandparents, or people at least used to want to believe that the grandparents were very polite, and they really weren't. And people lived rich, full lives, and that tends to be papered over.
Well, I want to talk about another major character, Walton, Dulcie's father. He's lived with syphilis for many years, but he's also a successful businessman, buying and selling mines all over the world. Why did you decide to give him such a unique yet horrifying trait, especially for someone of his status?
Well, in fact, a lot of people suffered from syphilis. People who traveled, men with appetites of any sort. I mean, Oscar Wilde had it. Tons of people had it. Calamity Jane had it, you know. So it was a fairly typical disease of the age, and all the cures were wide-ranging, and none of them worked. And one thing, too, that had always struck me about the period is it was sort of right on the cusp of the modern world, and everybody thought a cure for everything was possible.
Mm-hmm.
The world was going to be their oyster. Everything was going to be curable. Everything was going to be inventable. And he is an inventor, and he's an obsessive, and it all just sort of fit together. So really, syphilis was not an unlikely disease to give somebody.
And that kind of leads into my next question. So in my mind, you know, Walton is this known womanizer, and paired with the syphilis that he's knowingly passing on, even killing his wife with the disease, mm-hmm. in my mind, he's kind of a monster in a way. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he's very good to his daughters. He really treats them with respect, and it's kind of hard to know how to feel about him. What are your feelings about Walton, and why did you write him that
way?
Well,
I guess I wanted a level of discomfort and realism, and we all love people who are more than 60% an a-hole. You know, we really do. I also think that he, you know, people didn't always know when they were giving it. In the case of his wife, he probably didn't know at that time. He uses various methods of birth control, supposedly. But no, he's a monster. But a lot of men were then, and still are. So I don't know. You think of the AIDS crisis, think of other diseases, people are still doing this to each other.
That's true. That's true. So he was a good guy and a bad guy all wrapped into just regular person.
I like gray areas. You know, I think most people are not entirely good and not entirely bad.
Well, he's very meticulous, and he writes down everything in these bound notebooks that only he and sometimes Dulcie understand, and that's when she's called in to decipher her father's writings and ramblings in an attempt to discover the large sum of money that went missing in his care. I thought it was interesting that while her father treats other women as objects to fulfill his desires, he treats Dulcie with respect, kind of treating her as an equal. And he seems to trust her more than he does even his own business partner, giving her like keys and account numbers to keep safe. Why does he trust her so completely? Why is she different than other women in his life?
I think that Walton is one of those men who really just loves women and just cannot help himself. And if the women he was infecting, a lot of them were prostitutes, well, then he'd hired them. So the question of respect is sort of, it was a business arrangement, yet another business arrangement. She's his daughter. She's smart. He also respects his mother-in-law. He respects his other daughter to some degree. So I guess that may not be realistic, but I don't know that Dulcie entirely stands up, but he relies on her because he's used her to help him get around the world when he's ill. And I guess they've evolved into a sort of odder relationship that way.
Well, he has a few sons as well. Why not the sons?
He thinks of them as sanctimonious, and they're businessmen. They don't want to travel, and they think he's crazy. And she's put up with it. So in a sense, she's being a very obedient little girl, in the beginning of it at least. She starts traveling with him when she's 15, and I think she thinks of it as her way of seeing the world, and she's eventually trapped as something like his caretaker. I think I use the analogy of somebody trying to handle a large dog on a leash.
I suppose on one hand, she's kind of being that obedient daughter, but she doesn't, I mean, she still stands up to him too at times, like, hey, you know, I'm not going to sit here while you...
Well,
you know,
but that's realistic. I mean, you don't, yeah. Think of the classic father-daughter thing. It's not always smooth sailing. She runs away occasionally. She doesn't do what he wants her to do all the time.
I thought their relationship was very interesting and just kind of, you know, in the flashbacks of, you know, their travels together and things like that and what she put up with and things like that. But he's also very supportive of her and her times of
In a way. He respects her. Yeah, he does.
Well... let's talk about sex.
Oh, dear.
Sex was a pretty taboo topic back in those days, at least to my knowledge. Yet this book is full of it. So we've got Dulcie's womanizing father, her pregnant sisters, rushed wedding, Dulcie's own negative experiences with sex. Why did you decide not to shy away from this topic?
Well, people had it, and and they had it a lot. And I another thing about doing research in the period or reading diaries or this or that, everybody knew everybody else was up to something. So I felt that was actually fairly realistic. People might not have talked about it or necessarily written about it, but there's no question. Think of the Bloomsbury crew, you know, think of most of Paris. Think of everybody who lived at the turn of the century in Greenwich Village. People had affairs routinely, multiple ones. And this was just, and people had premarital sex too, or ran into violence as she does. So I did, you know, have fun with the idea that she, when she runs away, the only way she can really have some independence is to pretend to be a widow. If she were just an unmarried woman living on her own, people would really be eyeing her. And one way to be invisible and one way to be independent is to be a widow with some money. She gets a little bit of money and she goes a long way with it. But it also means that people think that she's more knowledgeable than she is, that she's more worldly than she is, and she has to play along with that role.
That's very true. And I want to go back to that, but first I want to talk about Victor. Walton's business partner and Dulcie's ex-fiancé. Mm-hmm. So what was his deal?
Well, he was screwed up. But we all know screwed up people. Yeah, obviously. He's violent, but he's, you know, basically mentally ill. He lashes out. He has trouble. I don't know if he's... maybe a little autistic, a little, something's off with Victor, and it plays out quite tragically.
So Dulcie breaks it off with him, and I thought that was really cool that she, you know, stood up for herself in that way and just like, no, I'm not putting up with this.
Well, but she finds it unbearable. I mean, you would, right? I don't think anybody would want to live with that.
Well, no, yeah. But a lot of people...
People did,
aren't
yeah.
strong enough to...
yeah.
Myself yeah. included yeah. at times in my life, so...
yeah, gotcha, yeah.
So on the other hand, Henning was Victor's
cousin.
assistant, cousin,
yeah.
henchman. Mm-hmm. He didn't always agree with Victor's actions and actually tried to keep Dulcie away from Victor, kind of running interference between mm-hmm. them. So why did he remain loyal to Victor? Is it just because they were related? You know, why did he stay?
I think because he's his cousin, because he works for him, because he sees what a mess it is. He thinks he can protect her and keep her away. Because really, I suppose, what are the options besides leaving Victor or killing Victor or doing something like that? I don't know. I tried to make it uncomfortable for him, too, and to make it clear that he knew he'd failed her, and he tries to come through for her in the end, and in fact does. I think Victor is a fairly uncontrollable person. Mm-hmm. There's that, too. I mean, what do you do when you find yourself getting into a worse and worse situation? How do you know when to stop things absolutely or
True.
Run for it?
Yeah, I guess I thought it was interesting that, you know, she was like, enough is enough, I'm out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with you. But he kind of stuck with him, even though he probably knew more than she did about what kind of person
he was. Well, he also has his life savings involved in this lost mine. I mean, he really has no money without Victor's money. Mm. It was his money that was lost, too, when Dulcie's father has forgotten what he's done theoretically with the proceeds from some mines. And so they're all involved in that. They all need that money.
That's true. I didn't think about that.
Henning has his own dreams. He wants to produce plays. He wants to escape all this and have his own life. So the financial, you know, imperative, there's no question. Somebody in an interview brought up the fact that I made it easy on Dulcie by giving her enough money to run away, which most women didn't have. I mean, that's exactly when women were stuck with somebody like Victor. But she has some.
That's true. Well, that's the thing I really liked about it, was just that she had that option and she took it.
Yeah. She bolted.
So I'm sure, and you've talked about, you did a lot of research about this time in history, and some less common topics come up in the book: traveling to foreign lands, mining, earthquakes with huge death tolls, wacky cures for syphilis. How did you do your research?
Well, part of the reason I wrote the book, I did have, for some reason, a vision of a woman just walking off a train in the West and disappearing. The other thing that sort of led me to it is my great-great-grandfather was a mining engineer, and he left behind some notebooks that were filled with bad poetry, mining receipts, newspaper articles, and he traveled everywhere. He was a Cornish orphan, like Walton. And he worked in mines until he got enough money, sailed to Nicaragua, went through Chile and Mexico, had a brother who settled in Mexico, just like Walton's brother, and eventually made his fortune in the West, the silver mines in California and further north. And, you know, the notebooks are pretty interesting. They're not, unfortunately, as interesting as Walton's, but... But that just sort of, I thought about doing a nonfiction book about him, and I finally kind of wanted to just use it. He had a daughter who married very unhappily, who was my great-great-grandmother, or great-grandmother. And, you know, I thought she should have run away. And so I sort of put my woman jumping off the train and my great-great-grandfather together and let it spool. He did not have syphilis. And I believe he was a nice guy. But, you know, who knows why you make things up. But that's how it started. And then it was, why would she run away? Where would she go? How would she do it?
Interesting. Okay, so kind of some real historical things going on there. Do you spend a lot of time going through, like, microfiche or?
I read a lot. I was doing a documentary, helping some people with a documentary on Butte. And Butte was an interesting town. In 1905, it had almost 100,000 people. They pulled more copper out of Butte than I think any other area of the world at that time. It had 100,000 people, and you'd look at newsreels from just a little later than this period, and there's not a cowboy hat in sight. It's a very urban town. There were 40 different language newspapers there. So there were Syrians, there were blacks, there were Chinese, there were lots of Croatians. It just, Italians, they'd bring in trainloads of grapes and make wine there. And it's still sort of a democratic stronghold and a free-thinking union town. Obama marched in the 4th of July parade in Butte. So it's an odd place, and it's sort of, there's a lot of the sort of hidden West that's like Butte. And I wanted to play with that, too. I wanted to write about it.
I didn't know that about Montana, but I suppose.
Well, I know, and it's not what it's not. It's really not all the Marlboro Man. Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, the West, you know, for one thing, not to get down on the coast, because I love coming to Portland, but people forget that the West was almost sort of used as a colony by both coasts. All the mining proceeds went to either coast. The lumber went to either coast, you know. Look at what happened to the tribes. But it's also a place of people running away and reinventing themselves, and very smart people, for whatever reason, settling in towns. The thing about, I have a lot of food in the book because I love food and I used to be a cook. But I have a friend whose parents and grandparents did always send a crate east for lobsters and get oysters back. And it would go back and forth. People ate well, you know, there was an opera. And it's a very varied place with odd and idiosyncratic people, just like anywhere else. So.
Well, it sounds like it was probably really interesting to go through all those things and find out about, you know, what it was like, and that it was very urban and kind of diverse and global. Mm-hmm. Surprising. For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking today with author Jamie Harrison about her new book, The Widow Nash. Well, I did want to ask, Dulcie ends up in a small town in Montana to start a new life with a different identity. Why did she choose a small town?
Well, it's not, for one thing, most towns in Montana are small. How's that? Because it's, of course, where I live. I live in Livingston. I've lived there for 30 years. I don't know. I sort of go through her reasoning. She didn't want to stay in Missoula. She didn't want to stay in Billings. There were only a few choices. And it seemed like it was just big enough. You know, 7,000 people at that time is probably just big enough to sort of drop in. If she'd been in a larger town near the mines, she might have run into somebody who'd known her father or had known Victor. So it's sort of a hidden place.
And Livingston has a colorful cast of characters. How did you come up with people? Are they based on people you know or people you read about in your research, or just...
Well, you know, again, I think that's fairly... One thing I'd look through is a city directory from about 1905, and I think Livingston had a colorful cast of characters. I mean, there were photographers, there were writers, there were lumbermen, teachers, bankers. There was a poorhouse filled with alcoholics. You know, I mean, there were opium addicts, there were Chinese. There was a little bit of everything, just like there really are in a lot of towns in the West. I mean, I think there are some very... there are some towns, certainly in Montana, that are just primarily ranching or primarily ranching. But Livingston now and then has a lot of writers, has a lot of artists. And so probably I was pulling from that. But really, realistically, there were odd people from all over the world and the country living even in that little town.
And is there a lot of kind of documentation about things that happened there? I'm thinking.
Sure, yeah, newspapers, okay. Stuff like that. I mean, I wrote this over a period of years while doing other jobs, and I have the bad habit of trying to stuff too much in. So, you know, want to travel someplace? Make Dulcie go. I had to cut a lot, but I did a lot of research, and I basically then just put it away and started writing. It is fiction. There's a Mark Twain quote that I really love, and it's find your facts somehow and make the truth fit it, and not to get into alternative facts in today's world. But, you know, I made it up after doing a lot of research. I just sort of tried to soak it in. I tried to think of the right kind of language to use that wouldn't be dated and stilted and too careful. I wanted it to be fresher. I didn't want it to feel historical, if possible.
I think you achieved that. I mean, I felt like it was something that could have happened at any point in time.
Right.
And I thought it was neat how she kind of fit into the town and made her place in it. But people seem
kept
very
kept her secret. Yeah.
Yeah, people seem very welcoming. That's the thing about the small town in my mind. Small towns,
they're
like,
curious.
I grew up in a small town, and it's like everybody knows everything about yeah. everyone else.
Oh, I know, I know. And they eventually know almost everything about her, too.
And yeah. what they don't know, they make up.
Yes, but absolutely. It's true. I grew up in a small town, too.
I do want to ask about earthquakes, because mm-hmm. earthquakes came up frequently throughout the story. So Walton, Dulcie's father, was fascinated with them and kept a record of them in his notebooks, and they even experience a few firsthand throughout the story. Is there a deeper symbolism to the earthquakes in the book, or do you just like earthquakes?
Just the idea that Walton would have been one of those people who, again, thought they could serve, that they were living in a time where every scientific problem could be figured out, could be foretold. He thinks he can come up with a machine to tell people when earthquakes are about to happen, and he fails utterly. But it was just sort of indicative of that mindset of a scientist at the turn of the century, or a pseudoscientist at the turn of the century. And I had fun with it. They also gave me a way to sort of meter the pace of the book, and to gave me an excuse to send them around the world. And, I like writing about obsessives, and it was an obsession that sort of made sense to me.
And I think earthquakes are kind of a hot topic here, because we're due right. to get one any day now.
You got the Cascadian Fault. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I live near Yellowstone Park.
Oh, so you're... Yeah.
We actually had I slept through it. It was over 5 on the scale.
Oh.
Yeah, just last week.
Yikes.
I didn't feel a thing. I have felt earthquakes out there, though. They're just little ones, not the brand you guys might have, but...
Well, and, I've only lived here for less than 2 years now, and everybody keeps talking about the earthquake, and I have no experience with that because I grew up in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And then we go back to Nebraska to visit, and what happens while we're there?
An earthquake.
An earthquake.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, so to me, the most interesting part of this story is the idea of starting over. I often think about this. I've fantasized this and about this in points in my life where things weren't going well, and I just wish I could just like run away and start over. But it would be really hard to pull off, as Dulcie found. If you were going to fake your own death and start a new life, where would you go?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that for years. When I was in my 20s, I was cooking in New York, and I wanted to run away to Australia. I think I was going to start a tomato farm or something. I was out of my head. It was just time to run away. But I haven't thought about it in years. I sometimes still almost want to run back to New York. Sometimes in the middle of winter in Montana when the wind is blowing, I just want a city again.
New York, not like Tahiti or something?
Nah. I mean, yeah, I'd like to. You see there's a lot of vicarious travel in this mm-hmm. book. So obviously it was years when I really couldn't travel much. I was working a lot. I had children. I had sick parents. And I was pretty much locked down in a snowy Montana town. So there is some running away, by and large. Research is running away. It's just killing time. You're not getting any work done. You're just sort of suddenly deciding you're going to spend 2 weeks looking up earthquakes. I don't know. There's a lot of ways of mentally running away.
Do you
and fiction helps.
That's true. And yeah. that's a lot of times, when you're reading fiction, you're kind of mm-hmm. escaping to a yep. different life, too. Do you think, if you were to do that back when, in 1904, when Dulcie was doing that, you would go somewhere different than you would if you were going to do it today?
I don't know, because really, I guess in truth, I ran away to Montana. I lived in New York for 5 years after school, and I worked at magazines, and I worked catering. I worked for a film company, and I ran for it when I had a job I wasn't enjoying, and somebody had offered me a house on the National Forest Line in Livingston, where I'd been when I was a kid. It was a beautiful, beautiful place. I knew it. And the house, this beautiful house right on this beautiful mountain, was $150 a month, so I bolted. Oh. So, no, I think I did it, actually. Maybe that's the answer.
Well, we were just talking about would you go to a big city where you can kind of blend in because mm-hmm. there's so many people, people wouldn't pay attention to you, or would you go kind of somewhere more remote?
I think you go to the other side of the grass, kind of. What's the right phrase? I mean, when I grew up in a small town, too, and I moved to New York. And then when I was tired of New York, I moved back to a small town. So it looks like I could ricochet that way for quite a bit, for quite a while.
Definitely an interesting topic. There was an episode of the podcast Criminal, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And they talked about, you know, how you could do that in today's
not very easy
time. Yeah. And just all the things to consider and how you have to break ties with family and things like that. So that was kind of in my mind when I'm thinking about Dulce and thinking about I can never talk to anybody in my family again and how will that feel and am I able to do that and start over?
No. Yeah. Very few people really do that. And that's a problem for her. It's a huge problem for her. Or I hope it came through that it was. She's very lonely. She really misses her sister. But virtually everybody else that she really cared about is gone. And so that probably makes it easier.
That's true, and that's probably part of the reason she was able to do it in the first place. Well, you touched on this a little bit, but I've heard publishers can be pretty ruthless with their editing. Was there anything you wrote into the story that you were disappointed that your publisher edited out, or was there anything you would have added if you'd had the space or it worked for the story?
Not really. I had a great editor, Dan Smetanka, and it may be that there were some, you know, we went back and forth on some things, but he would cut some things or suggest cutting things, and then I would actually usually cut more. If you put a book down for a month or two, it's much easier to go back and just be ruthless. And it almost always is for the better. So I actually didn't really mind. I mean, if somebody had asked me to cut a line right after I'd written it, it was going to be much harder than looking at it in the cold light of day and just thinking, oh, this is just trash. Get rid of it, or it junks it up. And I also, part of what I did between the time I wrote Mysteries 20 years ago and this book is I wrote a lot of screenplays, none of them produced, but I did it for money. And I think that helps. It helps teach you to cut and pacing and just being brutal with stuff. You've got to say it in less.
Well, so you talked about how you wrote some mysteries 20 years ago, or the last one came out in 2000, is that right? Somewhere around there?
I think so. I don't actually know.
Are you going back into the writing thing?
I've got about half of another book done, and I'm enjoying it. Done it between, you know, getting this out the door. And it won't actually be historical. Most of it's set in the present day. There's one chunk that's 1919. But yeah, no, I love writing. If I could do it all the time, I'd do it and give up a day job.
Well, what kind of books have you been reading other than, you know, what you've written?
Boy, I just finally read Penelope Fitzgerald, and she's wonderful, and I feel like I'm too dumb to really take her on, but I still enjoyed it. I loved Lincoln and the Bardo. God, who do I like? I wouldn't mind at all being Kate Atkinson. I like people who can get away with keeping a lot of balls in the air, and I do tend to overstuff my writing, and whenever somebody can really pull that off elegantly, I love it. I really like Richard Flanagan, David Mitchell, all sorts of people. Boy.
I put you on the spot.
No, I know, it's hard. I'm trying to think of the stack of books I haven't read by my bed.
Well, I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell the listeners about your book, The Widow Nash?
Unfortunately, no. I can't think of anything. One thing I did, the book is illustrated, and that kind of helped me through points when I was having trouble writing, having trouble thinking of a next scene. I had images all over my office walls, just sort of trying to immerse myself in it, and anything that was just sort of weird and wonderful that I found. And it really helped. It was really fun, that part of it. It wasn't so much research as just something to riff off of. Sometimes I would just simply write a whole other scene that I hadn't planned on writing and then have to try to stuff it into the book based on an illustration.
Were these things that you just happened upon when you were doing research?
Yeah, I was doing research. Okay. And mostly images from the time. Some of them are earlier. Some of them were just sort of the mood for a chapter, and they kind of, that and epigraphs and the earthquake lists and the journals, the book's sort of roughly organized around Walton's journals too. and that all, it's nice to have something that gives you pace.
Jamie Harrison, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.